Now, I probably mentioned it earlier, is the way I got started as a reliability engineer was my boss asked me to determine how long this product, this new product in our company, was a particular heating cable, would last. And the cable was engineered and designed so it could be buried in concrete and prevent the roadbed from building up ice. And the first customer that was requesting this product was the Italian government and the teams that were maintaining the bridges in the mountainous region in northern Italy. So immediately I thought, oh, this is great. I'm going to get to go to Italy for 20 years and find out how long these last. Well, that didn't work out quite that way. And so we looked at a range of different tests, and I'm certain I'm going to mention this first project in my career at length at another time. I think I've said it before, the best reliability test or accelerated test, or I shouldn't say accelerated, the best test for the reliability performance of a product is simply to give it to the customers and let them run it for its natural lifetime, and then track that very closely and understand how it worked. Now, many times we don't have that luxury of waiting for customers to tell us what's wrong with a product or that it lasts long enough or it doesn't, because then we have run the very real risk of losing customers. Because if we don't meet their expectations right at the start, they may well look for other sources of solutions for whatever this product provides. Now, I've heard it. I asked this question back when I was first looking at accelerated testing. I asked Wayne Nelson, who's written the book Accelerated Testing, how do you go about designing an accelerated life test? And he said, first, you give the products, all of your products, to your customers and find out what they report are the failures and how long it lasts. Then you'll have the appropriate information to create a perfect reliability accelerated test. Well, oftentimes we don't have that information. So we have the next best thing, maybe a previous product or a similar technology. And sometimes we don't even have that. But by far the easiest and best test is just give it to your customers. And if you think of it as a test, it'll help you with the data collection ideas, but also keep in mind that the customers are really the final arbiter as to whether your product lasts long enough or not. Now, accelerated testing or accelerated life test, ALT, has got a number of ways that it can go horribly wrong. And most of the time, though, we put the investment in and we think through these things and a handful of others to make sure that the test itself is going to give us good information when we're finished. One of the characteristics of an ALT is that we're applying stress to the product, in generally in a controlled fashion, in order to excite the failure mechanism we're interested in. Well, one of the things that can happen is that if I say elevate the temperature because I'm concerned about the performance of the power supply, that elevated temperature may significantly change the have a completely different acceleration factor for the linear digital circuits. And so that CMOS technology may well be excited for its particular failure mechanisms, but it also may be excited slower, such that a failure that would occur earlier in the field will occur later in the test, and so the power supply failures trump or eliminate that product before the linear digital circuits fail. Or vice versa, if I'm interested in the power supplies and I'm elevating the temperature, and another component, see these linear parts, fail, but because their response to the accelerants is different, it may be more, it may be a higher acceleration factor for those parts. So it's something to keep in mind that as you design and carry out your testing, is that different parts of your system, which have different failure mechanisms, may respond to the stress that you're applying in completely different ways. And so as you run into failures, you do need to do the failure analysis to make sure that you're exciting and accelerating the things you think you are at the rates that you think there should be occurring. And you can be fooled. I remember one time there was a consumer product and they were very concerned about memory failures in the field. It was a very high set of DIMM failures that was occurring in their fielded products. So they brought it back into the lab and they started doing testing, and they found that the CPUs were failing much more dramatically than the DIMMs. Well, it turns out that they were masking the DIMM failures because the acceleration factor for the CPUs was much higher. And so the CPUs were failing and precluding the ability to see the time to failure for the memory. So it's something to keep in mind as you're considering putting together an accelerated test. The other thing is to look at, is the failure mechanisms that you're generating, are they expected or not? Now, if you get an unexpected failure, if you're, say, using vibration for an accelerant, or you're using thermal cycling, and something else fails other than what you were expecting, well, again, this is going to get repetitive, I'm sure, is, again, do the failure analysis and understand if that failure is something that you should add to the list to be concerned about, or was that an issue that was isolated or not. But generally, any failure is gold. It gives you the information you need to understand what possibly could be going wrong with your product's design and manufacture. And then another part here is to take a look at the different types of acceleration models and the different types of accelerated testing that's possible provide a range of different stresses. And not all of them have a linear relationship between the stresses. So it's keeping in mind that accelerating something at a high frequency versus a low frequency is similar in some cases, in some circumstances, to going through a phase transition. So if you're testing above 100 degrees C, it's no longer any water that's available in your products, but now it's steam. And maybe it's that transition, that significant expansion in volume, that could cause problems for your product. But lots of materials have phase transitions, and they have completely different, in most cases, have completely different performance parameters after or as they cross a phase transition. So it's another one of those things to be cautious of, is that, yeah, you can crank the temperature up really high, but pulling out a melted pool of material is not exactly a useful failure mechanism for your use conditions, unless that's what your product actually should be doing. I'm putting these caveats right up front because there are plenty of things you need to consider as you actually implement the design and implementation of an accelerated test. There's a whole slew of other things to think about when you're setting up a test. And some of this should probably be back in the planning section. But the idea is to respect the constraints. For that example I talked about in the opening, for this heating cable, my boss expressly wanted an answer within 6 months. So we pretty much had to get moving because the test typically took 4 to 5 months before we got meaningful results from what we did with other products. But there was also chambers and data collection methods and preparing the samples and looking at measurement accuracy and reducing measurement error. Plenty of other things that were part of our constraints. Now, we knew quite well the environmental condition where the product was used. In your case, you may or may not know that. But the environment is more than just the weather. Temperature is not the only accelerant. So it could be water exposure or wind load or a mechanical loading and unloading, a cyclic mechanical weight being applied or mass being applied to your system, and so on. So understand and characterize those as early as you can so that you can use that information to create your product's accelerated test. The other part of what we try to do is to minimize assumptions. Just like in regression, statistical modeling or regression, we try to minimize the number of variables to describe what we're trying to model or describe. And so you can create very, very complex models to describe failure mechanisms, but it really should be as simple as possible, but not any simpler. And I think that's a paraphrasing a quote from somebody. I'm not sure if it's Einstein or somebody else. But the idea is that the more assumptions we make, the more risk we take that the numbers we get out at the end of the day will be pretty much meaningless. So think through what you're assuming. If you're assuming a constant failure rate, does that really apply? For example, if I'm assuming independence, well, does that really apply and how can I test that? Is the model I'm creating to describe the degradation of the system, is it linear or does it have a curvature or a plateau where it doesn't go below a certain level? So there's plenty of different assumptions we're making, and depending on which models and approaches we take, you may have more or less assumptions. Guiding principle, though, is really to minimize the number of assumptions, and those that you do make is to verify them. It's check to make sure they're valid. The bottom line, though, for any of these accelerated tests is, well, what's the failure mechanism? The difference in my mind is that I can test a system for how long it'll last, but any system, even a simple system, will have hundreds, if not thousands, of ways that could fail. So which ones will be the life-limiting elements for that product? So if this product is being exposed to thermal cycling and we expect the solder joints to fail, well, I can do a test specific for thermal cycling and those solder joints. Maybe making test boards to isolate and have continuity measurements through those joints so we can detect failures as soon as possible. But it assumes that none of the other failure mechanisms will be the dominant failure mechanism. So what if it's a portable system and it's dropped? Well, how many drops can it survive? And what kind of forces can it withstand? And that might be the appropriate life test. We might not know exactly how often a product is dropped, yet over time we could probably come up with some reasonable estimates and make some measurements and get a decent sense for that. One time I was working with a game controller, and the question came up for, is a million button pushes appropriate on the buttons on the game controller? They were considering looking at a new technology for the buttons or a new vendor. And I asked the question in the meeting of, well, how often do you push the button? Or how often do the customers push that button? And nobody knew. So we set out over the next couple of months to measure it, to create an environmental characterization of how often the different buttons were pushed. And then we design the accelerated test and the interpretation. But you need to understand the environment. You need to understand the use conditions. But you also need to understand what's the apportioned reliability for this particular component or specifically the failure mechanism. So buttons can fail for all kinds of different reasons, but if it's just mechanical wear that is our expected failure mechanism, then that expects a certain style of test. But if we're looking at drop damage to the buttons, then that's a completely different kind of test. And so these are all kinds of things to think of besides this slide and the previous one about what do you need to keep in mind as you're putting together an accelerated test? Now, just like giving your product to your customers, which isn't always that practical to do, we can do some tests where we have, no constraints. So if I'm able to take a suitable number of samples, or a large number of samples, I should say, and run them in real time and get simulated customer interactions with them and keep them running, but I have a real kinds of variability. So it's not in a lab. It's give your early prototypes to your employees and let them take them home and play with them and use them as they're supposed to be used is a way to figure out if your product is reliable or not in some cases. So if your product is intended to only last for a few months or for a year, then giving it as a beta or an alpha test where you give it to a controlled group of people and let them manipulate it and play with it and use it. That's a great way to go about doing the testing, because you get the actual customer experience and sets of stresses on your product. There's no acceleration factor to worry about. It's just a matter of collecting the data. It takes time, and it's hard to do well. So oftentimes we do have constraints, and that works pretty well when we can do it that way. It's really no assumptions other than the task of trying to pick the right people to do the testing for you, or the evaluation for you. But some of the problems I've run into is that once it gets into the hands of either potential customers or preferred customers, say, it may well land on social media. So if it doesn't work, it may get a black mark really early, which will damage sales. Also, you're taking time that during which you're not selling the product, because you're trying to collect data at that time. So it has some benefits from a strictly testing conditions, but from a business point of view, it's not always the best option. The next most simple type of accelerated test is something I call time compression. It applies to products that have a function that is only used part of the time. So I'm thinking of an alarm clock, for example. Is it set and used once a day, for example, maybe twice a day? I do like taking a nap once in a while. But the idea is that if that mechanism is only used for, say, a few seconds a day, and I want to test that mechanism of when the clock hits the trigger to set off the alarm, if that mechanism works, we could probably figure out a way to test that many more times per day than just waiting for the clock to come back around and trip the trigger. We could manipulate the clock so that every time it rings, we could reset it for a minute from now. And so we could potentially do 60 tests of that mechanism every hour. Now, I probably want to automate that part. But if it's used, say, a solar panel is used, say, on average 10 to 12 hours per day, just making up numbers here, because it's not being used, it's not creating electricity overnight. So if we're looking at the active elements, then just running it full time by getting artificial lighting, we could double the time that the test replicates per day. And others where it's only used, say, an hour per day. If we could get it running continuously in a meaningful way, that's a 24 times acceleration factor versus the 1 hour per day. So you get the idea, is that we just run it more often. Now, of course, that only really works when we're dealing with something that's only used partially through the day. So we take advantage of just being able to run it more often. Now, it also assumes that we're not creating any artificial failure mechanism by running it more often. The classic example of a toaster, that if you wanted to do a 20 or 30 cycles of the toast heating cycle, for example, to test the attachment of the heating wire to the side of the chassis, that if I run one piece of bread in right after another and just keep the cycle moving, or just lock it into heating mode, well, we don't get any metal movement as the metal heats and expands. And that is what creates the strain on the joint and creates a crack there. But if I keep it hot, that metal just never moves. Or vice versa, if I'm running something more often, I may be exciting a failure mechanism, either through heat or wear or fatigue, that's not appropriate or doesn't occur as fast as when we use it in normal conditions. So make sure that you think through the failure mechanism, and that as you do that set of stresses that excite that failure mechanism, is make sure that it's getting a full cycle and that the amount of damage that needs to accumulate per cycle actually does accumulate. Solder joints are like that. It takes time for the solder joint to have damage accumulate when you do thermal cycling, and hence the dwell time at the high and low temperature. That is what is allowing the solder joint to strain relieve to that stress, and that's when the damage occurs. So I can do it more cycles per day. It's easy for the acceleration factor calculations, but it's more difficult and because I'm making the assumption that the doing something more often translates directly to the amount of damage and as occurs just once a day, for example. Now, I mentioned acceleration factor, and we're going to define this and look at it a little bit earlier or a little bit later, but it's basically just the time shift. So this plot is a Weibull plot of a cumulative distribution function, and in this particular case, I have two failures. Let's see if I got my pen working here. And so you get a perfect fit. That's pretty convenient. But at this point is my use condition. And in testing, I had my 2 points and they failed fairly quickly. In less than, looks like 25, less than 30 hours, I had my two failures. And so the acceleration factor allows me to shift the entire curve. What it's basically doing is taking a parallel line and plotting it out, then multiplying this curve by the acceleration factor to get the corresponding point here. So I'm multiplying the time element of it. So here 30 times, and this looks like 3,000. Looks like a really big acceleration factor I've got here. So that's 1,000 to 3,000, almost 4,000. So it's a little over 1,000x acceleration factors on this in this graph. So it's, but it keeps it parallel. These two, oops. All right. As I was saying, these two lines are parallel. And the acceleration factor moves the entire line over in as a parallel line, the amount of the acceleration factor. So oftentimes we think of it as it moves the characteristic life. The 63 percentile somewhere in here for a Weibull distribution. And let's see if I've got it in here. It's a little hard to read, and I'm quite sure it's even harder to read on your screen. But anyway, the idea is the acceleration factor takes my test conditions and allows me to translate those to use conditions. And that's what we're doing with accelerated testing. So if I'm able to use something much more frequently than it would be used in practice, the acceleration factor is that ratio of use versus in the test versus in actual operation. Pretty straightforward. Benefit is it's easy to explain. It's easy to do the extrapolation, and if you discover that your usage condition has changed, then you can change your model fairly quickly and interpret it fairly quickly. But it's not always useful when you have a timed, where it's time dependent. I need the full day, for example, whether or not the product is in use, in order for the damage to accumulate. So say dust buildup, right? I can simulate that in other ways, but using the product more often might actually clean off debris and dust rather than let that accumulate and be the source of the problem. So like servers that are in use 24/7, well, there's no time left during the day or the week to accelerate it and to continue operating it. So we have to look for other ways to create acceleration if our product doesn't fit this fairly simplistic model. So the basic idea of, and this is an example of a steel that has a SN curve is another way of describing this thing, SN. It's stress to number of cycles to failure, stress to life. And the idea is that a piece of steel can withstand a certain amount of load, and it's elastic. It doesn't accumulate any damage. So when I lean on the hood of my car, there's a certain amount of weight I can put on there, and that surface of that hood of my car won't dent. It won't deform. It'll bow just a little bit, but when I reduce the weight, it'll come right back to its original shape. Now, in some cases, I'm not even able to sense how much deflection there is, but it's elastic, so no harm is done. So we call that a fatigue limit. So some materials are elastic, some are not. It doesn't matter what load you put on it, it'll accumulate some kind of damage. So on many types of steel, there's a range of strain that you can put across that steel, and it won't create any damage. The metal structure itself won't change into generally a more brittle type of configuration. And at some point, that a change in the structure of the metal will lead to cracking, and a crack will propagate, and your beam or flange or shaft will fail. So the idea is that once I'm above that fatigue limit, it's going to accumulate damage, and it's proportional to the amount of stress that's applied. So if I'm applying a large amount of stress, the proportional amount of damage is relatively high than if I'm using a smaller amount of stress, so that each cycle will create a little bit less stress or damage to the system. Now, if I cycle this one 10,000 times, I'll get the same amount of damage as this one cycling, say, 100 times. And the notion here is that we're making the assumption that the amount of stress and the type of, or the amount of damage or the type of damage is proportional to the amount of stress being applied and when it's above the fatigue limit. Now, if the product doesn't have a fatigue limit, then that caveat goes away. But the basic idea here is that I'm assuming that the amount of damage is proportional to the amount of stress being applied. And I'm using steel as an example because it's one that actually works fairly well, or is modeled this way fairly well. Well, this one of the, I think it was an engineer, I don't know if exactly, I don't think he was a statistician, Miner, came up with Miner's rule that allowed us to take the number of cycles and over the number of cycles to failure for a particular load. So if I say that this is my first load, and this is my second load, and here's the number, the amount of stress that I'm applying. But I can calculate, or from previous testing, I know how many cycles this is to failure. This is on this part of the curve, number of cycles to failure for a given load. And since they're proportional, I can add them together. And the idea is that this total amount will lead to failure eventually. Now, these parts are proportional. So if 10% of my load is N1, which is this lower one, and 90% of the load is N2, this higher one, or vice versa, I'll get a completely different number of cycles, total cycles, to failure. So this idea is that we can set up miner's rule like this to tally up the effective amount of damage caused by each cycle at a particular stress. Now, this will make a lot more sense when I work out the sample problem and show you the step-by-step part of it. But this kind of question gets asked a number of different ways. But it's also this principle that we're going to use for creating stress-to-life relationships for our products. And so this could be time. It doesn't have to be cycles to failure. But as I apply more stresses, I end up causing the product to fail faster. And so I think the relationship on this graph would be reversed, but I think I have other charts that show what I'm going to be talking about. But the SN curve and this plot is usually done through experimentation to find out how many cycles at a particular load causes a failure. And then I use Miner's rule to apply that to my condition, my use conditions. So let's say I know that I'm above the fatigue limit 30% of the time at one cycle, at one stress level. Say that's my 30% of the time is there, and 60% of the time is at a higher stress. So I take the proportion. This would be the N for the 6, and this would be the N for the 30. And then it's just the ratio of the number of cycles that occur at those levels versus the proportion of cycles to failure that that would take. And it gives us a convenient way to tally these. And all right. But there's a whole slew of different ways to create these stress-to-life relationships. But it basically allows us, if we're doing it through experimentation, we can create that SN curve, or we can create a model that is the stress to the time to failure type model, a relationship that, do a plot here. If this is time, and this is opposite direction. So if this is time to failure, and this is stress, low, medium, and high. So the curve would be, the time to failure would be low for high stress, and so on. So the idea is I would create a relationship between the applied stress to the average time to failure to the failures. And if my use condition was out here, then I could extrapolate out to my use condition and figure out what's its time to failure. So it should be a little bit longer than your test conditions, or hopefully a lot longer. It's one of those things that traditional statisticians really don't like, is they regularly say, don't extrapolate beyond your data. Stay within your data. That's where you have information. Because we don't really know what if that relationship maintains a straight line after it goes beyond our lowest test point and stress. Now, that's where the failure mechanism part comes in, and we really need to understand those failure mechanisms so that we have some confidence, as not statistical confidence, but engineering confidence, that we can extrapolate our test results to use conditions. And that's how we use this stress-to-life relationship. Now, there's some models that already exist, and if our failure mechanism is already described by a model, we could use that. We could use that prior work. So it's very similar to the physics of failure type approach, where we understand the mechanisms so that we have a well-characterized relationship between stress and the use conditions. So in this case, there's Arrhenius models and Coughlin-Manson and many, many others that are available. But let's take a look at one that's called the Norris-Landsberg equation. It relates the number of cycles, thermal cycles, that a solder joint sees. It's based on Coughlin-Manson, and the amount of damage that occurs to the solder joint. So we can use that model to run a single set of thermal cycle tests rather than having to do multiple stress levels as in the stress to life approach previously. And we can then use the model to extrapolate that single test set of conditions to our use conditions. Now, the risk, of course, is that the model is not accurate for our particular mechanism. So in some cases, this works very, very well when the mechanism of failure is well described by the model that you're using. But it allows us to really simplify the accelerated testing that we may need to do. So that usually means lower cost and quicker ability to get to testing. There's a good number of assumptions, though, that are applied by using an existing acceleration model. We have the distribution elements, whether it's Weibull or log normal or exponential, and that comes with its own set of assumptions. But we also have, does the model actually apply in our particular circumstance? Are the variants and the changes in materials significant enough that the model no longer holds? Also, by only running one set of stresses, we're not able to check many of those assumptions. So we're assuming the assumptions are valid. And one of the things is that if we have a failure mechanism that only exists at certain temperatures, maybe lower temperatures, for example, if we're using the Arrhenius equation, or a masked type failure mechanism, and we're only applying one stress level, we may miss the impact of these other stresses. Now, there's plenty of different models. The PEX relationship relates relative humidity, and there's a relative humidity term and a temperature term using the Arrhenius rate equation. And it allows us to take humidity and temperature and use it as an accelerant. Now, PEX relationship is only really appropriate for plastic encapsulated components, electronic components, those black covered components, to check the seal of the component molding over the lead frame, over the metallization part. It's looking that there's no breaches or voids in there, and by causing corrosion internal to the component. So increasing the humidity or increasing the temperature may also accelerate many other types of failure mechanisms. And so you really do need to understand the failure mechanisms so that you can apply them a model appropriately. If you're seeing a lot of corrosion, say surface corrosion on the circuit board, that may not follow Peck's relationship. His model was based on hundreds of studies of plastic encapsulated components, PEMs, that had a specific failure mechanism. So if you're seeing something different, I would be very cautious of using Peck's relationship to interpret it. Norris-Landsberg, I mentioned earlier, is the solder joint model. It again has this Arrhenius term in it that allows us to, and it has the activation fixed for the solder system that you're using. So it turns out this is appropriate for sac solder. But it also has the ratio of the frequency of cycling, how often you're cycling it in use conditions or in test conditions. And then what's the magnitude of the change in temperature. It's a very common test for simple solder joints to have a thermal cycling and testing of 0 to 100 degrees C. And for some applications, it's even larger. In use conditions, we go from, say, 10 to 30 C or something like that. So we get a decent acceleration factor out of it, but it has all three elements. It depends on what's the magnitude of the temperature change, how often you change the temperature, and what's your max temperatures in use and in testing. So it's a fairly complicated model, and I think It was derived and created empirically by looking at lots of test data. So unlike a physics of failure model, this doesn't have material properties in it, for example, but looks at lots and lots of test data. I believe Peck's relationship is also done that way, looking at hundreds of different reports. So there's a couple of examples of existing acceleration models, acceleration factor models. Another type of test we can do is called a step stress. And here we need a model so that if I'm applying increasing steps of temperature and monitoring for failures at a particular level, say for half an hour or for half a day, and then I increase the temperature, I again evaluate the products looking for failures and so on, and I keep going until I get sufficient number of failures. But it really relies on the relationship of between the stress level that I'm applying and the acceleration that that applies to the product. So at lower temperatures, for example, it may be only a 2x acceleration. So 1 hour of testing is worth 2 hours in use conditions. But as I increase the temperature, it may go to 4x. So 4 hours of, or 1 hour of testing equates to 4 hours of use. And then I increase the temperature again, and now let's say I'm getting 8x of acceleration. 1 hour in testing then equates to 8 hours in use, and so on. And as I accumulate damage, I'm accumulating the equivalent usage time. And the intention or the assumption under this is that the stresses at lower, the damage caused at lower stresses is proportional and contributes to the overall performance of the product. And we can tally all the different stress levels, accumulated damage, in order to estimate what kind of time to failure would occur under a fixed stress level. Another style of test is called degradation test. And this was the one that I ran as my very first test. It was the heating cable, it was a polymer, and as it oxidized, it would slowly lose its capability to provide heat. And we can measure resistivity of the system, and it was proportional to its performance. So we had a pretty solid model and a pretty easy measurement to make. So what we did was take a number of samples, expose them to higher temperatures so that it would accelerate the oxidation process, and then periodically pull the samples out and measure them. And then what we ended up doing was getting a plot. I don't have a large clear area here, so I'm going to draw over the top of it. So I measured the products right at the start and just normalized them so they were all equal to 1 right at the start. And then periodically I'd pull them out and make measurements. So after a week, I had a little distribution of readings. And after a month, and after 2 months, and so on. And eventually, the products. And eventually, the products started to cross the threshold. And I think we used, and I need to turn my pen back on. We used a threshold that if the resistivity got to less than, I think it was 90% of its original resistivity, that we defined that as a failure. Now, the product actually still produced heat. It's just that it didn't produce as much heat as the same amount of current applied as it did previously. So we considered that our threshold to when it would fail, when it decayed or wore away enough. There was enough oxidation that we called it a significant change in its performance. Now, other products may be at wait until it's 50% of its initial performance or whatever value you want to set for your particular circumstance. But eventually then, we had products that most of our samples had failed. And so what we ended up with was a time to failure distribution, this is time, that described our time to failure experience of our products decaying in time. And then by doing that at different stress levels, we were able to extrapolate that back to our use condition. And so out here someplace, this time to failure distribution got translated through our acceleration factor. So it was a pretty simple test, a little more tricky with the mathematics, but it was a lot of fun. But some products allow you to measure its change in performance as it leads to failure. And it's pretty efficient because you can use very few sample sizes, a smaller sample size, and if you've got a decent model to explain the degradation, you can or translate the degradation to use, you've got a pretty efficient accelerated test. The bottom line, though, in practice, is make sure you know what the failure mechanism is and characterize that as best you can. Understand it. If you've got a model, that's great. If you need to create one, that's fine. But go to failures. Get failures so you can make sure that the failures you're experiencing are manifest from the same mechanism that you designed the test to find. There's so many different things that can go wrong that running accelerated testing is quite an investment. And it takes the investment in thinking through and understanding the failure mechanisms so that you increase the chance that you'll get a good result and a meaningful result when you finish the test. Now, there's lots of different ways to do accelerated testing. It's probably one of the longer segments. Everything from just run it in normal time to run it more often to create your own stress relationship to time to failure, to use one of those existing models, or if you happen to have step stress or degradation testing circumstances, there's alternates. Now, there's also a good number of other types of tests that are beyond the scope of what we can mention here, but the ones we brought up here, these six or seven, I think there's six of them, are the most common, and we'll probably see more of those as we go through the sample exam and run some other examples. In the next section, I'm going to talk about just a couple other models. I probably could have incorporated in here and just made it just a few more minutes longer, but we'll talk about a couple other models and some of the details about them in the next lesson.